Welcome to Diary of a High Net Worth Investor with me, Graham Rowan, Chairman of Beaufort Private Equity. Our community of almost 800 high net worth families in 37 countries have a unique set of opportunities, but also some significant challenges. In this show, we look at how to maximize the good stuff while managing the risks and the downsides. Who knows? We might even make investing feel like fun. There are serial entrepreneurs and there are serial entrepreneurs. My guest today is in the latter category, at one point having set up at least one new business every year for 30 years. Trained as an engineer, that disciplined approach has stayed with him in all his business ventures, which include Cosworth Engineering, Quantel, Classic FM, and what is now one of California's leading wineries. In 1989, he was knighted for his contribution to British industry, and we're proud to have him as a member of Beaufort Society. His name is Sir Peter Michael. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I'm always fascinated by the background and upbringing of people who go on to be successful entrepreneurs. What was it like growing up in Croydon, where your father was chairman of the stamp dealer, Stanley Gibbons?
Well, it was a very depressing period in many ways. That was post-World War II, and Mum and Dad had somehow or other managed to keep the worst of the news from Germany away from my sister and I. And we didn't learn very much about it until much later. We were just a couple of kids playing around in the streets a lot of the time, playing around in the back garden. Middle-class family, hard-working. Mother who tried to do everything she could for us. And then as we grew, of course, the question of education arose. And my father left school when he was 14. He was one of four brothers. He had his father had died before he was born. And so he was the one in the family who made a success of life and was able to support the rest of the family and his widowed mother. So that was he was a natural businessman. And he clawed his way up the business ladder until he managed to become, well, he was chosen as the managing director and then the chairman of a private company, which was the famous Stanley Gibbons, known globally. Opened offices around the world, particularly in New York, and took it to the stock market. And then I was at his feet, really.
Brilliant. So for you, you graduated in engineering, then you worked at the big engineering firms like Smith's Industries and Plessy. And at what point did the bug bite that made you leave the safe salary behind and start your own business?
Around about 10 years old, I think. I was pretty determined that I would find a way of making a penny here and a penny there when I was in my early school, sometime very early in my teens. I think the very first thing I did was probably trading sweet coupons. And then the various other things, edited a magazine, which I tried to sell without much success at a penny a copy. And then the first serious go at business came when I was 18 or 19. And I was keen on electronics. Those were the days of tubes or valves, which we called them, and designed something which was, looking back on it, actually quite clever. And it became a kit of parts. I had a girlfriend, and together we started this business of putting together little boxes of resistor valves and chassis and an instruction book on how to build a FM tuner for Rutum, just introduced, BBC's FM transmitter. And we ran it for a couple of years and sold a few hundred, and that funded my first motor car.
awesome. So you were doing this kind of on the side while studying, and then later on while
working. Yeah, my girlfriend, then to become my wife later, typed up my university notes and did the banked the postal orders and put the kits in the boxes whilst I tried to read a bit of engineering physics or whatever it might have been then. And she was a huge support and has been, she worked like a slave then and she's continued to work like a slave ever since and has been a huge support. So that, perhaps that comes to the first important thing about life in business. You need to do it with a partner of some sort. That partner can be a bank manager, it can be a girlfriend, in my case, or it can be a business partner. But whatever it is, you go through these roller coaster phases where things go badly, and you very often need to cry on someone's shoulder or be supported or support them. And so partnership, I think, is a key element to being successful in any field.
No, absolutely. And I think if you can have your spouse actively involved in the business, that's enormously beneficial because they then understand what you're going through. And as you say, it can offer support and help as well as practical assistance. But I think your first significant business launch was it in the late 1960s that you came out of the engineering companies and set up your own consultancy firm?
Yes, a consultancy firm. It was called Micro Consultants. That's right. Well, I'd been working for Plessy for a few years. I'd engineered, crawled up the ladder of Plessy from being a salesman with a Cortina, which I rapidly modified to go faster and particularly around corners quicker, and ended up by writing it off one night on the old Roman road in Swindon. I realized at that point that probably the few years I'd had in Plessy, which was a terrific training ground, working in a big organization like Plessy that had budgetary systems and processes, taught me a hell of a lot. Before that, I'd done the equivalent of an MBA, which was a college 3-year course at night whilst I was working for Plessy, which where I met a lot of the left wing politicians to become later trade union leaders, and I listened to what they had to say. Clive Jenkins, who offered to increase my salary as a electronics engineer by 50%, and I thought there's something wrong about this. So they educated me, but didn't convert me.
Oh, you mean you'd have had you as a union official on a 50% higher salary? Is that what you're saying?
He was saying he had a room of 100 people he managed to get together and was lecturing them on how badly paid we were, and that he would find a way of getting our salaries up by 50% over the course of the next 2 years by the usual process of trade unions. Ah. So I did not get recruited to being a union member. A lot of people did.
How different history could have been if that had happened. Yes, indeed. But you launched this company called Micro Consultants. Of course, that's before we even had that term for personal computers. So what were you consulting on and how did you grow that business?
Well, I'd been involved in this business in Plessy, and it was at the beginning. So the transistor was invented when I was 10 years old. William Shockley in Bell Labs put together the first transistor, and that really has dominated my life ever since, in some way or other. Of course, that now becomes not one transistor, but 5 billion or even more on a chip. We passed that stage on the number of chips, transistors on a chip, each one of them being a switch. So it was a case that I had seen an opportunity. That opportunity was, in fact, to dominate also some of the rules of which I have applied. You looking for things to do, you can do the each discipline. You can go and do something. If you're going to do property, you can do property. You can do commercial property, or you can do housing property, or whatever it's going to be. If you are going to be really successful, in my experience, you need to look for the interstices between disciplines. And of course, it was all analog. It was an analog world. Television was an analog world. and it was going to change to digital. But to do that, it was clear that you needed a connection between the analog world and the digital world in both directions. And so that was the opportunity, how to do that. And there were plenty of things that offered profit to do that. They were all large. They were all expensive. They were all clumsy. And I had set to thinking that there might be a better way of doing this, and designed the fundamentals of what became Micro Consultants, which was to be a consultancy company. But within, as soon as one did a consultancy job, you looked at it, and the commissioner, chairman of a company or an chief engineer in a company, would look at you and say, "Well, that sounds like a very good idea. Can you do it?" And so the answer was, obviously, you say yes to everything at that stage of a company's career. And we became a manufacturing company within a few months of becoming a consultancy company. And the manufacturing company was very easy to create because we were within a very short range of Plessy. And the production manager thought it would be a very good idea to join this small company making interesting things, and did so, and brought with him half a dozen of the best ladies on the production line who clambered straight into a chair and got going. So within a 12-month period, we'd moved from offering advice on designs of microelectronics into manufacturing it.
Wow.
I mean, not literally making the micro circuits. No, we didn't do that. But we were able to put them together in an intelligent way, which did things. And we bumped into very little competition in the UK. The principal competition for that came from America, a company called Pasteuriza. Pasteuriza dominated the US and still does in its new name form. And we dominated the UK. And the comparison was dramatic. The other manufacturers' equipment would have a cost price of in the region of £1,000 to £2,000 per unit. Our cost price was around about £20.
My goodness. And are we talking about UEI now? Is that what this company
is? No. This is Micro Consultants.
Okay.
And
okay.
So the story of Micro Consultants moved on. I mean, it's existed for another 20 years as but it didn't actually go very far. It was a component designer and supplier. What really changed the whole thing was we were at an exhibition, one of those conferences where there's an exhibition attached to it, and two new important inquiries came into that show. One of them was from ITV, the new television company. Remember, I'm very old, and this is all. I'm much older than you, and it goes back a long way. We are now talking about the 1970s when color television was on its way or had arrived. But what had not arrived was a way of connecting the US television standard, which is a different standard from the UK one. PAL is 50 frames per second, and the NTSC American is 60 frames per second. And that causes a great technical difficulty, which is obvious to anyone who's thinking about it. And there was a need to find a way of broadcasting television internationally in both directions. And that was the inquiry. BBC had one of these huge devices, which they had fabricated internally. And an aside on that is that the BBC had, with the license money, funded a major development operation inside the BBC, completely starving industry, private industry outside, which they should have been using for designing and getting the UK's technology. But no, they wanted to do it all inside, a little bit like BT probably as well. ITV, on the other hand, had to do some internal engineering, but they recruited a number of suppliers from outside, of which we were a key part. And I made myself being very helpful to ITV at the time, who had development labs in London, in Kensington High Street. And I was always popping around to see what I could do to help, and learned about what their problems were, and ended up by recruiting the three principal engineers of that operation into my company, and starting a company called Quantel, Quantized Television. And that, through trials and tribulations, fights and successes, eventually became a hugely successful international public company providing television digital equipment to the world. And that was probably achieved around about 1980, something like that, round about then, from 1970. So I started it when I was in my 30s. I took it public when I was 40, and I sold it when I was 50.
Well, great. And I think there was a multi-million dollar lesson there that I don't want anyone to miss, which is when you said that what you did was look for intersections between these disciplines, between these technologies, and therefore effectively create whole new capabilities where you became the market leader because you kind of invented the capability. And I think that, you know, because I know you've worked across so many different sectors, I think that that seems to be a hallmark of your career, that you've looked for how you can bring skills and technologies from one area to apply to another and create something entirely new from that.
Yes, they are very often the same thing, but they just call different things. And in a conversation between the two separate disciplines, the words disappear into a hole in the middle because the other side. So you need a simultaneous translation to make that operate. So that was one bit of it. And the second bit of it was equally important. It was a military inquiry. So they a moving target indicator radar is a military requirement. That is to say, you want to see radar pictures, not of all the traffic. You just want to see the moving bits. The static bits are of no consequence, generally speaking. To do that, you have to subtract one image of radar from the next image, and you get the difference, and that is the moving bit. And that is possible to do on the ground using quartz delay lines of one frame duration to subtract one from another. That involves keeping the temperature of the quartz to within 0.301 of a degree. Now, that's whilst it's possible on the ground, now consider trying to do that in an aircraft. And it pretty rapidly deteriorates. So the quality of the cancellation between frames immediately deteriorates. And the way to cure that is you use digits instead of analog delay lines. And so the question was, could we produce that sort of device which required radar's fundamentally analog, it's not digital. And so you take the analog pictures, turn it into digits, stick it down a series of digital delay lines and shift registers, and subtract one from the other, and out at the end comes the picture you want. And that worked. And thus we were into military equipment manufacturers, which we managed to prize open and turn into another business all by itself, which had profit margins which were quite attractive and still continue to be attractive.
Okay, so with the result of all that, you eventually had several very successful exits. So I just wonder, you know, in what sense, because you seem a very sort of grounded individual, but you had this enormous success, which at some point translates into financial success. Did it change you in any way? Did you suddenly feel different now that you'd kind of, you know, had one of these liquidity events and were arguably didn't have to work again for the rest of your life?
I couldn't think about that. I mean, I think I believe I was trying to do things as opposed just to make money. I hoped it would make money, But by doing things well, I thought the money would find its way into a bank account at some stage. I mean, it wasn't quite clear how that was going to happen. So the question of being private or being public now, of course, is an absolutely major question, problem, and indecision for many people. So the fun of running a business as a private company is definitely much higher than running a public company. So my father gave me some good advice. He said, if you get an opportunity to be a director of a public company, then you should do it. And better still, if you are chairman of a public company, you should do that. But don't do it for too long, because it's really a killer of a job. Trying to run a company, a public company, is probably one of the most difficult things that man has invented for man to do. The reason is you're trying to satisfy so many different groups of people, and they all have their own ideas. I used to get a headache on a Friday afternoon when a busload of 20-something-year-old fresh analysts would drive down from the city and come and sit in my office and explain to me how I should be running the business. And you have that. Then you have the internal. You have the people inside the company. You have then you have the shareholders, the stockholders. I mean, they all deserve to be satisfied. And then you have the city, and then you have the scribes. The scribes, of course, are probably some more very clever. They can be very helpful. And it's important to always be on the right side of the scribes. Don't tell them to buzz off. It's not a good idea. You really want to try to explain to them what it is you think you're doing. It may not work, but if it does, at least they appreciate being taken into your confidence. Of course, that is one of the questions, is how much you should disclose to scribes. And what I tried to do is tell them about things we had done on the basis that it was something we were going to do, so that a little bit of success, you could then announce that you'd done it, and then you could tell them what the next thing you'd done, and you were going to do that in the next period. So that sort of maintains a relationship which was
that's a very, very clever strategy, actually. But also now, of course, if you were doing that today and running a public company today, you'd have the whole ESG agenda and lobby, where they're trying to put a whole bunch of arguably social or government responsibilities onto companies, you know, for everything from the environment to, you know, the community, the homeless, and everything else. So, as you say, I mean, now running a public company comes with a lot of burdens attached to it.
Yeah. I think what you're probably hinting at is that in the things you are interested in, you do very well, are largely private companies. They're not quoted companies, and that has a tremendous amount of potential, and also a tremendous amount of a possibility of disaster, probably more so than in a public company. You don't go public if you have anything other than a very, very strong and stable business. Well, in my view, you don't. Okay. So I've not done public company work now for a decade at least, and I don't think anyone would have me at this stage of life. I'm beyond the stage where by the city code, you are supposed to be a company chairman, although people do. The city rules now also really apply to significant-sized private companies. So you don't escape them, but and you have to have this thing. I remember personnel managers. You remember personnel managers? Personnel managers have become something called HR managers, and they are largely there to interpret several books of rules that you have to follow, which don't include anything about having to make payday at the end of the week or month.
Exactly, that's right, because these people have never actually run a business and faced those kind of challenges. But just one of your other successes, just a personal interest here as a lifelong Formula One fan and former amateur racing driver, tell me about your involvement Cosworth, who produced, I think, the most successful Formula One engine in all of history.
The DV8, yeah, that's right. Keith Duckworth designed that. He designed it pretty much on his kitchen table. Brilliant, brilliant, irascible man, God bless his soul, who decided that there was going to be a socialist government at some stage in his career and that he wanted to have a bit of money available to live on because he wasn't at all confident of what was going to happen in the future, much as I feel now, actually. He approached UEI, which was called at that time United Engineering Industries, and wondered whether the company would offer to take him over. And so for a very modest amount of money in those days, Cosworth joined UEI, what was UEI, and became an integral part. So we were able then to refine the public company strategy to, and incidentally, strategy is a very loosely used word. There are some, you know, the away strategy days. The most terrible decisions get made on away strategy days, and the ruination of a company can happen on an away strategy day. It's a good idea to have a chat about things, but not to take it too seriously. But anyway, we could refine the strategy in UEI then to being advanced engineering, sound and vision, and advanced science. And as such, we were the only public company on the London Stock Exchange, which was really a techie company. And I could, on your theme of racing, I could sit on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon watching a Grand Prix race and know that the engines had been analyzed and designed using the electron microscopy of one of our companies, the television cameras that were being used to televise it were made in another part of our company. We had the links between the outside broadcast and the studio were another part of the Quanto was doing that, and so on, right the way through the studio equipment till the time it got transmitted into the home. And so the whole company advanced steadily until we got to the stage where it was time to merge with something else. I think, going back to Dan's advice, don't do it too long. I probably had done it for too long. In reality, I was getting probably stale, it was time I went. So we merged with another company, and off it went into another direction, and much of it quite successful. Some of it was sold off, including Cosworth, where it was landed up in the hands of, I think, eventually Ford, after having passed through a number of hands. And that perhaps wasn't the best home for it, although it was a home at least.
Yeah, indeed. And then, of course, there's another slight detour, and you end up as CEO of Cray Supercomputers. Now, I don't quite know how...
Well, actually, not Supercomputers. It was Cray Electronics. Okay. The supercomputer company is the American one. Right. This was communications company, but it was equally intense electronics. But it was British.
And how did that come about? Because you're already a successful businessman. You've owned your own companies and so on. What attracted you to take on the role of CEO there?
Well, once the public company that I was intimately involved in building had gone to someone else, there was an interregnum period when my waistline increased very significantly, and my wife got fed up with me being at home. So something else had to happen. And having a management team available who were prepared to also join allowed that team to be noted by the city. The bankers, of course, can't do anything. They know they haven't got a clue what to do. They need people to actually implement and do. Whereas they can fiddle the finances, so it's available. And so there was a company that was in trouble, a public company, a listed company, where there was a serious problem, and the current management had to be evicted. And we were drafted in as a team of three to rehash it. Now, it wasn't a terribly important public company. It was just a useful vehicle. But within a very short period of time, I got a phone call from a friend and a chairman of another big public company that offered to sell us a big electronics company called Cray. And because it didn't fit into what they wanted to do, they wanted to sharpen up their mechanical images and didn't want to have this odd bit of electronics floating around. And so we did the deal, acquired it, and that then shaped up, smarmed up that company. And we called the company Cray. And alongside that, the deal I did at the time was a certain amount of money, but they had a wonderful headquarters somewhere down in Hampshire where there was a fountain playing in the gardens. It was an old Edwardian or Victorian building, were very comfortable. And the pond had in it some wonderful looking carp. So the deal I did was if I bought the company, the price agreed, I wanted one of the carp. And come the day, our fishing friend went down there with a bucket, picked up one of the beautiful carp, and we have a few family hotels, and one of them's got a very nice pond in it. And that carp lived in the pond at Donington Valley Hotel for many years until a passing heron spotted it one day, and it disappeared that night. But it was called Doughty. That was the name of the company from which Cray was purchased.
I can just imagine this.
Big fish.
Yeah, I can imagine this complicated sale and purchase agreement suddenly under the consideration column having one carp.
I tried to blag it up to two, but they wouldn't have it. It was only one. They were worth a couple of £1,000 each. Yeah.
So everything we've talked about so far has got a very distinct kind of engineering bent to it. Then suddenly, in 1992, you decide to launch a commercial version of Radio 3 called Classic FM. And I think one or two of the so-called experts kind of rubbished the idea and told you you were going to go broke.
Yes. Yes. Well, it was something new. It wasn't that new in the sense to me, because I've been in television. And admittedly on the backside of the camera, not on the front end of it. But I knew enough about the business. And then Maggie Thatcher in 1990 passed the 1990 Broadcasting Act, which was all about TV. It created the franchises. And but down in the bottom right-hand corner, there was this little bit about three new national radio stations. One of them was going to be rock, one of them was going to be speech, and the other one was going to be classical music. And I came from a classical music background house. I mean, my mother was an extremely good pianist. And I'd done something that doesn't happen these days. I had a proper musical education at school, and I knew about music. My first discs were the first 12-inch one was Tchaikovsky's number 5, the Pastoral. And the first 7-inch one was the overture to La Traviata. And the third one, my first pop one, was it was Peggy Lee, actually, was my third one. I spent my university degree listening to Peggy Lee and fell in love with Peggy Lee. But that's another story. The BBC had thought they had the monopoly to public broadcasting across the nation. So radio stations at that point were only allowed to broadcast on low power to very distinct areas, the size of, Oxford and, the big station, the bigger stations, but they were London-based. And all of the national ones, the only national ones, were things like Radio Caroline, wasn't it? Offshore Luxembourg boat. Radio Luxembourg. Yeah, which were commercial. They had commercial. And they were, the Radio Caroline was in a big boat parked 12 miles, or was it 2 miles? Anyway, it was offshore. Was a light ship being tossed and turned. I wouldn't have wanted to be a disc jockey on or a presenter on that. So the opportunity came to apply for one of these licenses for national radio, I was invited to join a consortium. Now, doing something like this, you don't do it on your own, or at least most people aren't capable of doing it on their own. You need a consortium. And we had a consortium. We had to raise a significant amount of money at that time to effectively bid for the license. And so you put together a table, and the table had been put together basically by a small public radio station called GWR, which did stand for Great Western Radio. I was invited early on to join the consortium. And I took a look at that and thought, well, yeah, that actually is, that could really suit me after everything else I'd done. And it sounded rather fun. So we put that together and bid for it and promptly lost the bid to a higher bidder. But then came the question of, can the higher bidder actually raise the money? And they couldn't. So being number two, we had to do it by the deadline. We couldn't cross the deadline, obviously, the legal deadline by the government. And so we had to do it within a very, very short period of time. And I ended up being the major shareholder, which I didn't intend to do that. I didn't think I hadn't intended to become chairman, but that sort of fell to me eventually. And so off we were on another interesting ride, really. And, of course, licenses have a period of time when they are useful. You have to renew them and rebid. And that seemed to be approaching quite rapidly. So this was 1992. We launched on November the 7th, 1992. The press had said we won't last 6 months. The Financial Times said that they thought it was a very good idea, but it wasn't financially viable. We had 50 people saying no to us, and that's how I ended up putting in more money than I had originally intended to and becoming chairman. Anyway, it was a good story, and the opening, there were bets on what was going to be the very first track played, and it was Zadok the Priest. And so Zadok the Priest rang out at 6 o'clock on that morning, and it was then greeted. There was so much automatic publicity, which was amazing. Within the first 2 years, we had a million mentions of Classic FM. Wow. For which we had not paid. Fantastic. And it immediately went into break even and then into profit. And it eventually became, through manipulations, it became a public company with a market value of $1 billion, which was, blimey. This is a radio station. how did that happen? At which point I failed to sell any of my shares, being loyal, of course, to the company. Actually, I just thought maybe it was. And then along came Google. And Google eventually took over, just rained on our parade totally. Advertising from then on became the dregs that Google and I suppose now Meta and all the others have taken over 99% of all advertising, and you end up with the dregs. But nevertheless, it was we sold it eventually.
That's a great story. But again, brings us on to perhaps the love of your business life, which has been the California vineyard, and that's been a long running story. I know you have a mixture of all these different skills and talents, but what was it like going into a whole new sector, a whole new industry that you had no previous experience of? Because I think again there were naysayers who said, You're in the wrong part of the valley. You're not going to get a great yield. This isn't going to work. But you ploughed ahead anyway.
Well, you mean I didn't know anything about it? I knew the bottle very, very well. I knew the whole industry from the bottle onwards. But what I didn't know, you're right, I didn't know how it got into the bottle. And I thought you bought some grapes and you hired a very good chemist and you put the two together and magic came out. It's bullshit, of course. It doesn't do that at all. It's all rubbish. The whole of winemaking is in the vineyard entirely. And the winemaker does have to be a chemist, but his job largely is not to do anything to ruin what nature has done for you. So you must start off with the right terroir. I'd had a ride. I'd had a wonderful ride in Silicon Valley. It had treated me very kindly. And I just moved valleys. I moved to the Napa Valley. And have had a wonderful ride in the Napa Valley. Those two valleys have been exceptionally kind to me over the years. And trying to cut this as quickly short as I can, I followed the footsteps of Robert Louis Stevenson, who traveled those parts in the 1880s and 90s, and ended up where he honeymooned on the mountains. A mountain called Mount St. Helena, not to be confused with Mount St. Helens, which blew up, which is 1,000 miles north. Now, Mount St. Helena was the model for Spyglass Hill in Treasure Island. And we ended up by buying a square mile on that for $1 million, which we knew would grow grapes. The University of Davis had done tests and said that you grow grapes, and you say, well, will they be any good? And they say, well, you have to plant them to find that out. So we planted them, and the first year we sold them, which was 4 or 5 years later, it turned out that they were very, very good and commanded premium prices of 2 or 3 times that of the general market. And so having found that out, it was but a small step to say, well, in that case, we're going to build a winery and make wine. And that started in, well, we bought it in 1980. We probably built the winery probably in the late 80s. And that was a struggle. I mean, if you think planning permission is difficult here in the UK, well, wait until you get to California. And you, of course, have to fly across there and wait in this word, effectively planning court. And all of the public come in and object to everything. And then we even got to the stage where one day one of the participants had a heart attack in the middle of all this, and we had to stop it and go back again. And the chairman said, well, we've flown 6,000 miles to come here. Call me, cast, carry on. No, you've got to come back again. Eventually we got commissioned and built a wonderful winery. It is the most stunning place. Most astounding place. It is also quite unique in the sense that it is probably one of the only vineyards of a handful in the world that produces Grand Cru, Cabernet Sauvignon, Grand Cru Chardonnay, in the same vineyard, but not at the same height. The Chardonnay is a couple of thousand feet up. And that has indeed been my great love of the family. I discovered that this winery, wine industry is a marvelous thing for a family because the whole family can take part in it. They can enjoy it. We have summer camp there. This year we had 20 young men and women of 18 to 22 years old. They're all beautiful creatures, they are too, enjoying themselves, swimming in the lake, jet skiing, partying, all awaiting their results on the 17th of August. And I'm glad to say they all got what they want, and they all went off to their universities, and those who were graduating from universities have gone off into their first jobs from university. Quite a memorable year, really.
Okay. Well, your son Paul and his wife Emily now sort of manage the vineyard on a day-to-day basis. Now, I was impressed by a comment he made when he was talking about the importance of continuity. He talks about 100 by 100, meaning 100% ownership and 100% commitment for 100 years. And you could only do something like that or have a philosophy like that in a family company that doesn't have all those pressures we talked about earlier on of a public company. Is that an approach that you agree with? And is that an approach you think we should all kind of adopt when we're thinking about the way we run our companies?
Well, that's a loaded question. You've got too many answers to that question, I think. But certainly as a legacy, if you have a successful business that can be a family business, not all of them can be. I mean, you couldn't do micro consultants as a family business, far too technical, if the family didn't get interested in. Many families have offspring who don't want to inherit the family. But of course, it has been the way in which France has really dominated the top quality end of winemaking. It would be wrong for people to get the idea that this is just a little vineyard stuck 6,000 miles away from the UK. This is a really important business in the family, and it deserves full attention for the 100 years. I've done 40 years of it. I'm working on the other 60 at the moment. It's not looking as though it's going to probably quite get that far, but you never know with the immunotherapy treatments that are coming along now. I hear that it might be possible the person who's going to live to 120 years has already been born. And the most exciting things are going on in the world of technology. I will send you a cheering half-hour video for you to watch. Your videos are, you have a way of cheering people up with your videos. I'll send you this one, and you'll at least, I think you'll enjoy it, because there is so much gloom of what's going on. We've got a government here that is steadily destroying commerce and industry as it goes through its ramification and exercises. Troubles that exist have largely been caused by the very same people, and we're in a sort of gloom debt spiral now, which is looking very, very dodgy altogether. We need cheering up, and this little video, I think, will cheer you up.
Okay, well, talking to you cheers me up as well, because you're such a role model. And if we turn from running businesses to becoming an investor, which is how we've met, because we're both invested in Glint, the company that's turning gold into practical everyday money. And I know you've also followed that up with an investment in a fintech group with us. You're looking at an aerospace fund over in Switzerland there. I mean, what are the criteria you look for when you're doing your own due diligence on something you want to invest in rather than actually run?
Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, I often think the best way to do the research is to invest a bit, and then you get to learn whether or not this is likely to go anywhere. But these private companies have ups and downs. I mean, they very often tend to go along sort of up and up a bit, down a bit, up a bit, down a bit, and then they do one of two things. Eventually, they either go down very sharply in the valley of death situation, or they suddenly go up. They found something really worthwhile. And the conclusion is it's pretty damn difficult to tell what they're going to do, really. There are plenty of people who think successful investing in private companies is purely a matter of luck. Well, I think it is luck. I do think luck plays into it. But in looking for an investment, any company that is started represents a major decision by at least one person. That company never existed until that one person made a decision and risked something to make it happen. Now, that's one thing, I think. And then the second thing is, I think you've got to look in the company. There needs to be one exceptional man in that company, someone who is outstanding, way beyond the general run-of-the-mill people. And if you haven't got that, the likelihood of it becoming a successful company is mightily reduced. Those two things, I think, are probably true. Then it comes down to the environment. You'll see in this video that I'm going to send you, there's a mention of this valley of death, which we all know about. You get to the stage where can you get to a satisfactory company working and profitable before you run out of money? And people get fatigued when they keep on having to dribble money into something. And that's quite right, too. It should not happen. That valley of death comes at various different times in a company's life. And right now, looking around the world, we've got a huge, huge number of companies that are entering or have entered the valley of death. And those, how many of those are going to survive is anyone's guess, but it certainly isn't anywhere near 100%.
You're a good example of that stickability, because you've had these challenges in some of your businesses and you've come through it. And I think the other thing that you're a great role model for is that we do not get to a certain point and just retire to the golf course. Because I, you know, where I'm based here in Portugal, I'm surrounded by people who've done that, and they're all bored out of their skull, you know, and they're only maybe late 50s, early 60s. So I think, you've been a great example of how to stay active, stay involved, and it definitely keeps you young. And yeah, I'm sure that you're a candidate to live to 120, and long may that be so.
Right.
So, Sophia, thank you very much for joining us today. Thanks for all those lessons you've shared. And I think there's lots of things that we can take from that as we look for our own entrepreneurial journey and our own investment journey. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you qualify as a high net worth investor because you earn more than £100,000 a year, or you have an investment portfolio of £250,000 or more outside your main home and pension, you can join our investor community free of charge at beaufortprivateequity.com.